For those of you who don't know me, I'm Martin Parkinson. I'm currently Chancellor of Macquarie University, but used to be somebody once. But I'm lucky enough to be able to be on the panel with two incredibly impressive and well-known figures and people who I'm very grateful to be able to say I've had pleasure of working with over a number of years. They are Governor Stephen Poloz of Bank of Canada, Steve, and Governor Philip Lowe of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Echoing what Alistair said, you've all had a chance to read their biographies. Their biographies in the booklets do not do justice to the experience set and the wisdom of the two colleagues here with me, but I'm not going to go over that again. What we're planning on doing is about 40 to 45 minutes discussion between the two governors over some key themes, and then the remainder of the session will open up to the floor. I want to emphasise, though, that when we open it up to the floor, what we want is questions, not speeches. So as long as we keep that in mind, and like Alistair, I'm going to take questions in groups of two, three or four, so that we've got an opportunity to get as many questions as we can. With that introduction, gentlemen, when we had a phone hookup a couple of weeks ago, we thought we'd open up with a loosener to talk about the outlook for the two economies, what was common, what was different. At the time, coronavirus was only something just beginning to trickle into public consciousness. Can you touch on the outlook in both countries and compare and contrast, in a sense? And in particular, can you reflect a little bit on whether or not coronavirus is fundamentally changing the short-term, medium-term outlook in both either or both countries? Steve, would you like to kick off?
Well, sure. Thanks, Martin. Thanks very much. And it's great to be here. Great to be back in Melbourne since 2014 was the last time. Mm-hmm. So we begin this story in Canada in a pretty good place with unemployment at all-time lows and inflation on target and wages rising, arguably close to 4% per year. So a pretty resilient kind of starting point. Nothing's perfect. Of course, we've got regional differences underneath that. That means there's still work to be done. But what we've been watching carefully is the trade angst, I'll call it, between the United States and China in particular, and possibly between the United States and Europe as another front on that, and that angst washing up on our shores. And we've been watching this since the Trump administration came to power, because the first target was NAFTA. And so we had a reduction of investment across the board in Canada, business investment that has persisted. That thing hasn't been actually finally ratified, but that uncertainty is gradually reducing, but only to be replaced by this other uncertainty. And so in the last few months, we've been watching those things begin to accumulate. The global cost of the trade war is now quite significant. It's affecting Canada, of course, and certainly in the manufacturing sector. And we're monitoring whether or not this is beginning to feed through into consumer confidence and begin to slow the economy more generally. And we had some signs of that over the last few months, but they could be temporary. And now, as you say, we have a new shock, which I guess now we're supposed to call COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that properly, but that's why I see it written. And that's a very unknown thing. It's very early days in the sense of doing an analysis. We appeal to SARS, perhaps, as an experience, but that's nearly 20 years ago. The world has changed a lot since, so I don't think we have much to learn from that, except to wait it out and continue to watch. Certainly not a positive to the situation. It's going to cause lots of things to be lower. Travel, of course, investment, supply chains disrupted. You name them. There's definitely going to be an interruption to economic growth, and how persistent that is will determine how important it becomes in a macro sense. Besides the human cost, which is already tragic.
Can I ask you to speak louder, please?
Of course. I don't get that request very often. Anyway, I will do. Yes, thanks. So that's what I got.
Yeah, thank you.
My assessment's very similar. I mean, last year was not a particularly good one for the global economy or actually the Australian economy. We grew by 2%, which in many parts of the world we consider quite respectable, but in Australia 2% growth is not considered that respectable. And towards the end of last year, there were signs in the global economy that things were starting to bottom out and actually improve. And the IMF just a few weeks ago released its latest set of forecasts, and they were suggesting that the global economy was going to grow more strongly this year and next year than it has for the past 2 years. So the IMF was predicting things would pick up, and there'd been a slowing in trade and in manufacturing output, but that slowing looks like it has come to an end.
That's right.
So the IMF is thinking global growth will be stronger, and in Australia we're expecting growth this year and next year to be stronger than it was for the past 2 years. Growth 2% last year, closer to 3% this year and next year. Our resource sector is in an upswing again. We've gone through a cycle in the residential construction sector, which is playing out. And last year, households were quite cautious. They were fixing up their balance sheets in a period which house prices were declining. House prices are now rising. Households are feeling a bit more comfortable and they're going to spend a bit more. So I think absent the virus, the outlook in Australia was improving. I don't think the virus fundamentally changes that outlook, but it does mean that right at the moment things are going to be softer than we thought. Mm-hmm. It's having a major effect on the education sector. I think Melbourne's probably feeling that more than many other places. Mm-hmm. The number of Chinese tourists coming to Australia has skyrocketed over recent years. They're the biggest source of foreign tourists to Australia now, and obviously that's stopped. And we have heard some instances in over the last couple of weeks where Chinese companies have called force majeure and have had to interrupt exports to Australia or imports from Australia. So it's not on a widespread scale yet, but it is having an effect right now, and I expect we'll see the effects of that when we get the GDP data for the current quarter. Just in the last couple of days, the infection rate seems to have come down.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of people being infected, but the infection rate's coming down. So if that continues, I think we could have reasonable optimism that the number of cases would stabilise. And the Chinese authorities have made it very clear that they're going to stimulate in response to this. The central bank has already announced a number of easing measures to support credit. And President Xi last week said that they would undertake further infrastructure spending. So once the infection rate stabilises and the number of cases not rising, I think we'll see Chinese stimulus, that will be good for us, and we'll return to this gradually improving trend that we look like we were on before the virus.
So I think that what both of you said is probably the sort of common wisdom about this. We really don't know. It'll be a function of what happens in the infection rate. But think beyond this to some of the sort of structural pressures that this might raise for firms. We saw, going back, it's almost 20 years, I suppose, the Thai floods disrupting motor vehicle production globally because of parts supply. We saw SARS disrupting things. Does this coronavirus, along with the sort of trade tensions, create incentives for firms to shorten supply chains? That is to, does, in a sense, President Trump's sort of desire to bring manufacturing back to America actually end up occurring, not because of his policies, but almost in despite of what he's been doing? Steve?
Well, I can certainly see your argument. I mean, supply chains have been in existence for a long time. And they were never, at first, of course, they were characterized as offshoring, and that's the end of the onshore economy. And, of course, it was never so simple as that. Optimizing across all the fragments of your supply process, deciding where is the best match in terms of productivity levels and wage rates for that, the skill level that's needed to produce that fragment. It's a complicated thing, and of course changes through time as wage rates change and costs change, etc. So it was never meant to be a fixed thing and all in one direction, that it would always be adjusting. And one of the elements of that was risk. I can remember being well acquainted with the supply chain of BlackBerry back in the day when I was with the EDC, and they had seven different countries in their supply chain, in their primary supply chain, but they had found a duplicate or a backup supplier for every one of those and kept them active. So they're always actually twice as many as they actually needed. So it's not like a supply chain that's engineered by an engineer, right? So it was much less risky than being all dependent, so that, say, Thailand had a disruption, then your supply chain is completely disrupted. And I think that a little bit more of that kind of risk management might be what people are into, as opposed to shortening supply chains. I mean, I think that that's extremely costly, and perhaps, it can really, if you don't use a supply chain today to produce something that people can buy, just imagine how much your iPad would cost you if it were produced all in Canada or the United States. I mean, fewer of us would have them. And so the business proposition may not survive that kind of radical shortening of supply chains.
Phil?
The supply chain issue is much more an issue for Canada than it is for Australia. But given that, can I just take a couple of minutes to focus on the positives, if that's okay? Because this morning we've spoken a lot about the negatives, the risks, the geopolitical risks, the cyber risks. But we've got to remember that both our countries have fantastic fundamentals.
Yeah.
They've got great natural resources. We've got fantastic adaptable people. Our populations are growing more quickly than most other Western countries. Our societies are diverse, prosperous, and we enjoy standards of living that very few other people in the world. We've got fantastic institutions. We've got well-established monetary frameworks. And we've got strong public finances. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got to remember that. We've also got to remember that technology progress holds out the prospect of fantastic opportunities over the coming years. I mean, the advances that are going on in material sciences, in energy production, in healthcare, and in data science, they're opening up fantastic opportunities, and Australia and Canada are both really well placed to take advantage of that. And we've also got to look at the labour market. I think in Canada you've got the lowest unemployment rate probably since the mid-70s.
Yes, sir.
In Australia the unemployment rate's a bit higher, but a higher share of the population have a job today than ever before in Australian history. So people are getting jobs. The technology carries risk, but it opens up tremendous opportunities, and our fundamentals are strong. And sometimes I get a bit annoyed that we're all focusing on the downside risks and we're forgetting about the other side of the distribution, and that's the opportunities we have. And I think our two countries have just fantastic opportunities, and I hope we can return to the opportunities through the course of the day and not just focus on the very real risks. So that was a bit of a distraction from the options.
It was a very good distraction. It's a nice segue to the next issue that I wanted to bring in. But one other positive which you didn't touch on is that, in contrast to, say, the United States and quite a few countries in Europe, we haven't seen the same deterioration in inequality. It has, at the margin,
right,
got worse, but and it raises a separate question, which is not really for today, but why is it that we see the echoes in our public debate of the debates in Europe and the US when we haven't actually seen that deterioration in inequality? And that equality of opportunity, which is so important in both of our countries, is still there. Perhaps that's a topic for next year. But you touched on the robustness of our institutions and well-established monetary framework, which really does raise a question. Have we got the policy mix right in both countries? Think about the difference between the sort of emphasis on monetary policy vis-a-vis fiscal and structural. But Phil, you'd like to reflect on that?
Well, I'm not going to reflect on whether we've got the mix right. I can just talk about monetary policy. In Australia, we've got a flexible inflation target. Our objective is to keep inflation on average between 2 and 3%. At the moment, inflation's a bit below that. That's being driven by structural factors, globalisation and changes in technology. So inflation's a bit lower and growth is a bit weak. The central bank has responded to that with very low interest rates, and we think they're working, but it's going to take time. We've never been a central bank that's been obsessive about getting inflation back to the targeted value quickly. We want to deliver low and stable inflation over time. I think in Canada, on fiscal policy, you've had some stimulus. We haven't had any fiscal stimulus in Australia. The governments have focused more on infrastructure spending, and that's actually been really helpful, not just in managing short-term demand, but also adding the productive capacity of the economy. I think the monetary system is working well. We've got stimulatory monetary policy, and it's helping, and infrastructure spending is helping as well. And I think in Canada, you've had more help from on fiscal policy than we've had here.
Yes, that's certainly true. At least I won't make the comparison, but we've had help from the fiscal side in the past 4 or 5 years. It's made a significant difference, particularly when we had the collapse in oil prices back at late 2014, early 2015. We drove interest rates back down to 0.5%. And I know that, you know, having simulated with our models since then, that the policy mix has made a difference to our outcome. That, in fact, we would have had to push interest rates down at least to zero, arguably, you know, technically negative. That would be, you know, for us an experiment, but other countries have done it. We would have had to go much lower than we did and stay lower much longer than we had to, precisely because fiscal policy came to the fore and gave us around 1 percentage point additional economic growth, which is on the order of, say, 100 basis points difference in what our interest rate path would have looked like. So that was a pretty important difference, and arguably that's one of the reasons why we've managed to get inflation back to target despite that major disturbance back in 2015. So inflation is 2% now, and it's been because the mix has been a little bit more oriented towards getting that outcome. You know, we've been for the last decade or so, interest rates really low virtually everywhere, and for precisely this reason, we're all pushing something up a hill, and that even if, say, our economies were roughly, we call it home, you know, inflation at target, unemployment as low as it's ever been, employment as high as it's been, that's great, but we're doing it at extraordinarily low interest rates, and so we know we're still pushing against forces that are acting on the economy, and the mix makes a difference in other parts too, because it means if interest rates didn't have to go as low as they otherwise would in Canada because fiscal policy was pushing things up, that meant fewer financial vulnerabilities or housing, you know, excessive activity, housing market, so on. We've had plenty of that, don't get me wrong, but it's obvious that we would have had a more difficult or more challenging financial stability outcome had we had much lower interest rates and not fiscal policy. So the mix has an impact on those outcomes too. So not been perfect. However, it's definitely been a more helpful mix, I would say.
I want to come back to that question of in a low inflation environment, effectively how do you manage risks as a central bank. But before I do, Phil, you've been reported as consistently for a while now of calling for more structural reform in the Australian economy. What are the sort of areas of priority from your perspective that you'd be urging that we should be focusing on?
Yeah, I think my general perspective here is that investment in the country is very low at the moment as a share of nominal GDP. Mm-hmm. Public investment is around average, but private investment is very weak. We're also seeing quite weak productivity growth in Australia. Productivity growth in the 1990s, kind of close to labour productivity, close to 2%. In the following decade, a bit more than 1%. The last 5 years, barely 0.5% on average. So we've got low productivity growth, low investment growth. I mean, the economists argue what causes low productivity growth, but my perspective is that it's linked to low investment. And there's a paradox here, because interest rates are as low as they've ever been. Both the Australian government and private business can borrow today at the lowest rate since Australia became a country in 1901. So I've got very low interest rates, low investment, and low productivity. There's no shortage of areas for us to be investing in. You know, the population's growing quickly. We need to do more on infrastructure. There are endless opportunities in the energy sector, addressing climate change, human capital. We talked about the challenges before in the technology sector, and in data science as well. So, you know, the thing that I would like to see is both the government and business use the opportunity of record low interest rates, and I think we're going to be in this world of low interest rates for a long period of time, to use that opportunity to make investments in these areas, infrastructure, human capital, climate adaptation, energy production, and data science. Mm-hmm. The specifics on how to do that's not my area of expertise, but I feel there's an opportunity here for us to be investing in our future in a way that we have not been doing recently. And when interest rates are low and there's spare capacity in the economy, which there is, it's a fantastic time to be investing in our future.
Couldn't agree more. Particularly because you touched on the positives a moment ago, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that living standard growth in Australia has slowed markedly. If we want to have the same sorts of growth in per capita living standards that we've had over the last 30 years, that half a percent productivity growth per annum has to be five times that on an average basis, an average annual basis going forward. And that's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen without a pretty strong push. And I agree with you entirely about the role of investment in there. But can I come back to, Stephen, to what you were talking about before? In a low inflation environment, where we are seeing vulnerabilities build up, whether it's household balance sheets, whether it's corporate debt, whether it's national debt, how do you think about managing the vulnerabilities in this sort of low inflation, low wage growth world? As a central banker.
Yeah. Oh, that's all?
That's all, yeah.
Okay.
We'll come back to the rest of it for you afterwards.
Right. So the broad picture is something I'll go back to what I said a moment ago, that we've in many cases gotten back to a more normal place in the economy, and yet interest rates remain really low, suggesting there's still forces acting, probably legacy forces, from the global financial crisis. But through that whole period, interest rates having been so low, we've accumulated a lot of debt in the household sector, in Canada, certainly I can speak to. And that's identified as a vulnerability. It goes back to your mixed question. If you have one fiscal policy versus another fiscal policy, what happens is you're still pushing that rock up a hill. There's still a need to do some sort of stimulus. And if you use monetary stimulus, you create more household debt. If you use fiscal stimulus, you create more fiscal debt. One way or another, there will be debt accumulating during a period when the economy is being pushed against, you know, some sort of force. And so, that mix of policy affects which pile of debt is going up at the time. And so having a balance in that gives you a more resilient position for the next shock that comes along. But with interest rates already low, you know, the next shock that comes along, chances are you would rely more on a fiscal tool. Monetary policy is not without its without its powers. But we know since Keynes that this is when fiscal policy has its greatest power, ability to affect the outcomes. So there's an understanding of that. That's the backdrop. So the question then is, well, how does all that affect those vulnerabilities? How do we manage those vulnerabilities going forward? That, of course, means really having another set of tools, and that has been the macroprudential toolkit. And so we're actively considering these weighing these additional risks today. So if there's a risk that the economy will slow, then normally a central bank would consider whether they should lower interest rates to offset that risk, what we sometimes call an insurance rate cut, against a risk that hasn't been realized. But nowadays, because of the level of vulnerabilities in household sector and sometimes corporate sector, we think, well, if we lower interest rates, that will enhance those vulnerabilities. So trading, reducing one risk by increasing some other risk. And that risk is not just theoretical. It is that if vulnerabilities go up further, the next shock that comes along will be magnified in its impact on our economy. And so you may be able to get inflation exactly on target today, but at the cost of making it very hard to keep inflation on target down the road when a shock does come along, because vulnerabilities have gone up in the process. That's the time-wise trade-off that's active in our thinking now. So with those things, that just means there's one more source of uncertainty into that judgment balance. But when is the right horizon over which, as you said, you're not particularly wed to being, month or in the short term being exactly on target. And for us also, inflation targeting is a flexible business. That's why there's a band. And you'd say, well, I think it's okay to let that unfold over the next year or two, as opposed to being faster with it. So that's how they're managed at that level. But the best way to actually change them is to introduce additional macroprudential tools, such as countercyclical capital buffers in your banking system, or some sort of like we have a stress test for mortgage lending. We know today that the stock of outstanding household debt is improving in quality every week, because every new mortgage is a higher lending standard than what we were using before. Not that it was low before, just that it's this has become much more front and center. And so we've enhanced those guidelines. The result that I think we're doing okay on this front, and I think we're our financial system, I suspect you would argue the same, is a much better condition or more resilient place than it was 10 years ago, despite the rising indebtedness. It's debt per person as opposed to overall indebtedness.
Phil, we were pretty early on with moving with some of the macroprudential tools. Your thoughts on the same issue?
Well, I mean, the main issue in Australia is high household debt. Corporate debt's low and government debt's low, so the debt issue is really on household balance sheets. And I think about this from both a structural and a cyclical perspective. From a structural perspective, Australians have a lot of debt on their balance sheet, and we have very high housing prices. And that's a combination of developments in the financial system and choices that we've made as a society. We've got a very liberal financial system. It's easy to get mortgage credit. And the choices we've made as a society, we most of us have chosen to live in fantastic cities like Melbourne on the coast. We also want to have large...
Just note that was a Sydney cider who said, fantastic city, Melbourne.
Like Melbourne, and see, I could have said Sydney and Brisbane and Adelaide and Perth. You know, these cities that are,
no,
that are on the coast.
He didn't say Canberra. Or Ottawa.
The point I want to make, if you look around the world, where is housing expensive? It's kind of fantastic cities, mostly on the coast, that offer a lot of amenity. Yeah. And that's where we've chosen to live. We've also chosen to kind of have fairly large amounts of land for each dwelling. We don't really like urban infill that much. And we've, over many decades, we're fixing this now, but we've chosen to underinvest in transport. So I think kind of a first-year economic student could tell you, if you all choose to live in these kind of fantastic locations on lots of land and underinvest in transport, you're going to have high housing prices, and you've got a financial system that accommodates that. So we've made choices that give us structurally high housing prices and structurally high levels of debt relative to our income. We can debate whether that's kind of sensible choices for the society, but that's what we've done. And it's created a vulnerability, because we've got a lot of debt on our balance sheets relative to income. So from a cyclical perspective, the issue is, how do you manage that vulnerability given the structural factors in place? Now, the two ways, and really they echo the comments Steve made. We're conscious in our interest rate decisions that when we cut interest rates for cyclical perspectives, it encouraged people to borrow even more from an already high level of debt because of their structural reasons, and it's a consideration in our decisions. Even at the moment, last year, lower interest rates, I think, did help people repair their balance sheets, help pay their debt off more quickly. But perhaps we're moving to a crossover point where the lower level of interest rates are encouraging people to borrow yet even more which could create a vulnerability down the track, which could make it more difficult to achieve our objectives, as Steve was outlining. So that's a consideration. And the other policy tool is, Martin, as you suggested, is macroprudential. The approach in Australia is to identify those areas where the problems are most acute. A few years ago, it was the case that 40% of loans, mortgage loans being made in Australia, are interest-only loans. So they did not require $1 of principal to be repaid on a regular basis. 40% of loans were on that basis. And through the Council of Financial Regulators, we had this discussion. Is this really the position we want to be in? Housing markets rising very quickly and 40% of loans don't require any principal to be repaid. So together with the Prudential Regulator, limits were put on this, and that was actually quite successful. One of my reflections on that whole experience was that a couple of the CEOs of the banks called me up afterwards and said, thank you, which was weird. They normally don't thank you for putting restrictions on them, but something in the financial system was meaning financial institutions were making loans that they kind of knew weren't kind of in their long-term interest, but they couldn't stop. So temporary and targeted interventions, I think, did make a difference there and address the cyclical elements. But you know, we live with high housing prices and high levels of debt because of other choices we've made as a society, and there's very little the central bank can do about that.
Thanks. Colleagues, we're going to cover off a couple more issues very briefly. But for those of you who have burning questions, if you want to start to register. I've already got three lined up, but we're happy to take questions from the floor. So, oh yeah, we've got some more coming in. Yeah. Really interesting question for me as a macroeconomist is the gap between the risks that we see as economists and the extent of market buoyancy. Any reflections on what's going on?
Sorry, the gap between the ones we see and...
The extent of the risks that we see,
yes,
and yet the extent of financial market buoyancy in terms of stock markets.
So it's true that there at times seems to be a gap, but my motto is... you always ignore what the market is telling you at your peril, but they are prone to exaggeration. Okay, but that's only a acclivity. But I think when we go look at the bond market is the most central of this. What is it telling us? You know, it seems to be telling us that there continue to be important downside risks to the global economy. We don't agree with that. They're telling us that it looks like there's not about to be an inflationary outbreak. I think most of us would agree with that. And so they're telling us, I think, that, and they're at a level which some associate with secular stagnation, but really is more like a low growth scenario, which is driven mostly by demographics. And so that's life. You have the mirror image of that then in stock markets, extraordinary. You could say buoyancy, actually the corporate outlook tends to be pretty positive, and the discount rate is extraordinarily low, so price to earnings are going to be high levels. So, you know, we can quibble about the bumps and wiggles, and we go through phases of commentary. Like I remember a year ago, there was to be, you know, for certain a global recession in 2019. The world economy wasn't anywhere near that sort of status in 2019. But that was just, as I said, there's a proneness to be exaggerating the signals. But I don't think the signals were wrong that we were having a slowdown in 2019. And I interpret them in that light. I don't really have many quibbles with what the market's telling us. Mm-hmm. Phil, what do you think, Phil?
I'm a bit perplexed, but... As I said before, global growth, if we put aside the virus, was expected to be stronger this year and next year than it has been for the past couple of years. Yeah. So hopefully that means profits are stronger as well. And interest rates are the lowest they've ever been. Mm-hmm. In Australia, the 10-year government bond yield, I think this morning, is around 90 basis points. So we've never been lower than that. And in many countries, just recently, the government bond yields have come down. So the discount rates are right down. And because of the improving outlook for the global economy, asset prices are very high. Profits expected to be okay, and you're discounting at the lowest rates on record. What we're also seeing is investors faced with low interest rates on bank deposits search for more risk, search for more yield, and they're taking more risk. So we've got credit spreads in many markets back to very low levels, and we're seeing investors prepared to take more risk and more leverage, and I think that is a concern. Whether it's going to play out in an uncomfortable way, it's too hard to tell. But you know, people are prepared to take more risk when they're getting the lowest rates in history on their savings.
So just juxtapose that with what you were talking about earlier about how low investment rates are. How do we square the circle there? I mean, we've got investors seeking yield and taking risk and arguably mispricing the risk, so potentially misallocating capital. At the same time, in the terms of the real economy, we've got very low investment growth rates. Something's not meshing here.
I mean, investors at the moment are prepared to buy existing assets at quite high prices. Mm-hmm. The asset exists, they can discount the cash flows, they're discounting at a lower rate, so the cash flows are more, and so they're prepared to accept quite low yields now, or lower yields than in the past on existing assets. But that same logic is not being transferred to the creation of new assets. When I'm creating a new asset, I'm still wanting a hurdle rate of return of 12, 13, 14, 15%, and that number is not adjusted. At the same time, the risk premiums are high. You know, there's a lot of things to worry about, and you know, if business people were kind of listening to the discussion this morning, they'd probably push the risk premium up again. Yeah. So there are a lot of things to worry about. The hurdle rates of return, you know, I know from talking to some boards in Australia, have adjusted, but for many they've not adjusted. Yeah. It's almost hardwired into the corporate culture. In our business, we need a 13% risk-adjusted rate of return on equity. And that doesn't change, even though I think it's quite likely we're going to be in this world of low interest rates for years, perhaps decades, because it's driven by structural factors in the global economy. So, and I don't know why this is happening, but I think it's problematic, because if firms just distribute cash back to their shareholders, it's not going to generate future wealth for the shareholders or for the society. Now, they've got to actually create new assets to generate wealth.
Yeah.
And if they're requiring 14% rate of return on equity on these new assets, it's going to be hard.
Yeah. I think that's the crux, isn't it? So the last question I wanted to put to you both is, some say central banks should stick to their knitting and focus on monetary policy in a narrow sense. But when we look around the world, central banks are taking increasing interest in climate change issues. What's driving the interest? Dave?
Can I also say that I agree completely with Phil about his analysis of hurdle rates and so on, but he's observed the same thing, that for some reason hurdle rates, risk-adjusted hurdle rates, don't seem to go down with this climate. But another thing that's also important, I think, is that it's becoming very difficult to measure investment spending. And a lot of the investment spending, much more of it is intangible, and it's in forms that are not actually being captured by the statisticians. Yeah. And the same goes for productivity. My suspicion is that it's a bit like the later Greenspan years, when there's something going on that we can't actually see that's better than we think. But anyway, I'll just leave that at that. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. So if I get to climate change, I mean, I think central banks, certainly from my perspective, I think it is a good idea to stick to your knitting, and our knitting does include financial risk. And so financial stability risk is a major preoccupation, has been a growing preoccupation for central banks, whether they're regulatory central banks or not. Bank of Canada is not a regulatory central bank, but we still do all the analysis, as in our represented on our FSR. And so one of the things that climate change is doing is just shifting that picture So you're asking questions about, first of all, direct financial risk due to weather events. That just feeds right through the insurance companies and can affect the financial sector. But the second layer is more telling now. It's what we call transition risk. That is, over a long period of history, perhaps 30, 40 years, something like this, or 50 years, whatever, we're going to transition to a low or lower carbon emission future. And that means that path has associated with it risks associated with either financial institutions or companies to which they have exposures. And so that's just analyzing that and stress testing that the same way we do with household debt and how it may impact the financial system when there is a shock. I put climate change in that space, and the push for transparency and carbon footprint reporting, et cetera, is really aimed at making sure that transition, that everybody has visibility, whether you're an investor or other stakeholder, you have clear visibility on what those data are, so that transition can be a gradual, orderly one, as opposed to a tumultuous one when people suddenly wake up and say there's transition risk. So that's, well, I don't know if Phil would like to add to that, but that to me is the primary reason why you see central banks engaged in that.
Just Phil, just before you touch on this, one of the things we are seeing, arguably, is an increase in the frequency and severity of severe weather events. Seven of the last 10 years have seen the most expensive years in terms of natural disaster impacts globally. Do we need to stop thinking about these as individual negative shocks and begin to think of them as a cumulative system shock, which potentially lowers our future growth rates as well?
I think it's right to think of it as an aggregate shock rather than individual ones. Mm. And I agree with Steve as well that the central banks should stick to their knitting. Addressing climate change isn't something that's a core responsibility or any responsibility of the Reserve Bank of Australia. But what we do have a responsibility to do is to understand the economic and the financial implications of climate change. And Steve talked about the financial implications. But the economic implications are profound. The world is getting hotter and the climate's more variable. And we're seeing already in Australia, perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, the effects of that. Right now we've got a drought that's detracting this year 0.25% from GDP as it has for the last couple of years. The fires probably across the December and March quarters detract 0.2% from GDP. Climate change is affecting the nature of production in Australia, the nature of investment, ultimately the nature of our exports. At the moment, I think it's affecting confidence of people and therefore ultimately spending. It's affecting the availability and pricing of insurance, partly because of these extreme weather events. And it's affecting how we generate and distribute power. So the economic effects of weather-related events are really profound. So at the central bank, we're trying to understand the full dimensionality of those effects. And as Steve suggested, we're also trying to understand the financial implications, because if you accept the proposition the effects are profound, then it's going to affect asset values. Possibility of stranded assets, and if the assets aren't stranded, then some are going to be worth less. But importantly, other assets are going to be worth more. We have tremendous opportunities here as well. So when asset values change, the value of balance sheets change, and that has financial implications for institutions and asset managers. So we have to understand that. We're not responsible for designing climate change policy, but we are responsible for understanding the implications of it.
Right. Well said. Now we've got Norman Steinberg, Roger Gillespie, and Ashley Preston. I will take the three questions first up, and then we'll come back, and we've got Goldie Hyder and Siegfried Kiefer. Norman, do you want to lead off?
Sure. Thanks, Martin. A question for Stephen, if I may. Stephen, you alluded to in the public finance section of your discussion a number of minutes ago about the stimulus aspect of it. If I just take us back in Canada, I think it was about 25 years ago that basically we hit a wall, that our cumulative deficit was so significant that government policy from then on for about 20 years was basically to reduce cumulative deficit and get us back to zero deficits on an annual basis. Over the past four or five years, we seem to have an ever-accelerating policy of the federal government of deficit spending. I know some Canadian bank presidents have expressed publicly their concern about the level of deficit spending and what the implications are for when we get into the inevitable next recession, how we're going to deal with it. So can I ask you, are you concerned about the level of federal deficit spending, and secondly, where this takes us when we hit the next recession?
Okay, we'll come back to that. Roger.
My question.
You've just turned off.
My question, going back to the structural changes that could be possible, for both countries, we have a very strong university sector who are working on a range of different things that, if they can be hurried up, can add a lot of value to each country in terms of its productivity or job creation or both. Mm-hmm. My question is, what's your view as to how we can incentivise, encourage or finance the creativity that's locked away in the university sector?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Roger. Ashley.
Hi. So my question is somewhat related to the question of the first gentleman, particularly on the topic of economic resiliency. And while deficit spending can sometimes be a concern around economic resiliency, so too can regulatory uncertainty, particularly as it regards investment in hard capital. There's recently been an increase in regulatory uncertainty, particularly in the Canadian natural resources sector. And I was just wondering if I could, this question I guess is for Stephen, you know, is there a concern that that's actually a contributing factor that could be offsetting some of the stimulant effect of low interest rates in the economy and thereby reducing the resiliency of the Canadian economy?
Okay, thanks. Three great questions. Stephen.
Three great questions. So immediately after sticking to your netting, we get this enormous question about fiscal policy. So I'm going to stick to my netting and say, you know, that's really a question for a finance minister. But I think it's important to be clear about what some of the data points, okay? So I'll just comment. So in 1994... Okay, which is the period you're referring to, the federal debt to income ratio was around close to three times what it, or two and a half times what it is today. So it was a high number, and so it drew the attention of international investors. And so, as you say, we hit a wall, and there's been adjustments since. Today we have a 30% debt to income ratio, which is low. It gives lots of room to maneuver, so I don't really see that as an issue. And I think, you know, deficits also need to be kept in context. It's about what they're used for. So as a company, you don't force yourself to save for 20 years to make an investment. You borrow to make an investment because it grows the company. Households, we don't force them to save for 30 years until their kids have left before they can buy a house. Okay, they borrow to buy a house. So there's investment.
And get the kids out of the house quicker, though.
Well, when the government is making investments, it's helping the growth, the fundamental growth of the economy. And so anyway, that's enough comments on fiscal. And over to, I guess, you're going to answer this one about universities, I bet, because I could see you already.
I said stick to our knitting, didn't we?
Well,
you know. So we should just be clear. Ashley's from BHP.
So. Well, okay. So, but anyway, she asked a question about regulatory uncertainty, which, you know, I think this is what I hear from companies all the time. You know, they're talking about uncertainty. Our surveys tell us that companies for the last 3 years, 4 years even, have been primed, ready to invest. They know what they want to do. It's all lined up, and they're hesitating. And so would I if I had all that money at stake, given the uncertainty about what the trading system might look like, arbitrary shifts in the business environment, or, as you say, more regulatory uncertainty or just red tape in general that impedes our competitiveness. And so those are, of course, hard to quantify. Okay, so for as an economist, I always want to quantify, but they're obviously playing a role in people's decisions whether or not to invest. So it's right there in front of us. There's lots of places where we could do things to reduce uncertainty. And I expect, for example, ratification of the new NAFTA to be one such ingredient that will give a boost to investment spending in Canada and in the United States, by the way, and Mexico besides. So a very powerful thing, you know, that's been held back through the uncertainty period. We should see a rebound. We won't assume all of it will rebound. We argue that it's about $10 billion in Canada, so that we're short of where we would have been without that uncertainty. So hopefully, you know, a meaningful amount of that comes back over the next year or two, and that would be fabulous. Over to you, sir, Mr. University.
No, interest rates are hard enough. Okay. How to solve the problems in the university sector, I've got no idea, really. But I agree with you on the fundamental point. We've got, in both our countries, fantastic centres of higher education with fantastic staff. So it's a matter of setting the incentives that we can capitalise on their brilliance. But that's beyond my scope of expertise.
But I was, okay, so, but education services are a huge and growing export for both of our countries. And I can speak to Canada for an important source of labor, a qualified labor force growth. Like almost all of our new labor force growth is coming from immigration now, and that channel is the most important channel. What it means for public policy, well, I mean, it means, it's an important engine of economic growth from both of those perspectives. I'll say that much.
Yep. What you don't want to do is run an immigration policy that actually discourages people coming because getting that human capital, and particularly getting that human capital cheaply, has been a boon for both of us. Goldie. And then Siegfried. So, Goldie, over to you.
Great. Good morning.
Goldie is Business Council of Canada, and Siegfried is from ATCO.
Some of your counterparts, past and present, have been commenting rather heavily around the issue of sustainable finance. And it kind of reminds me of the one-handed economist. On the one hand, they're saying it is designed to encourage investment. On the other hand, some are saying it's designed to choke off investment in fossil fuels. During that time, concurrently, governments are making stretch commitments without any plans on how to achieve those commitments, nor are they providing predictability and certainty in terms of the carbon pricing, for example, what would it cost over the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. How does business reconcile those rather competing observations on the part of your counterparts? And what's your position on the issue of fiscal or sustainable finance? And if not that, then can you at least give us some advice on what we should be doing in business to navigate the situation we find ourselves in?
Phil, do you want to lead off?
I think there's a general point that policy uncertainty is bad for investment. And, finance follows investment. So the policy uncertainty is problematic, I think, everywhere, including in Australia. Having said that, there's been very substantial investment in renewables in Australia. We have fantastic opportunities there to reshape our energy production system, and that investment's taking place, but it would be enhanced by a greater policy certainty. I think everyone accepts that. Not just in Australia, but elsewhere. On sustainable finance, I'm not actually sure what the issue is you're trying to get at. It's the underlying issue for me is really investment. What are investments and businesses making in energy and the use of energy?
And yeah, the underlying issue is
the key issue there.
The underlying issue is those that would be making the investments, the energy companies, are the ones that they're targeting to essentially drive out of business, who then cannot make the investments in the innovation that brings about the change that everybody wants. That's the dynamic here.
Yeah, well, that's the same point, really. We need policy certainty so that businesses can actually get on with doing the investment that they need and the country, our countries need. I think that it's, the finance part is not the main issue. It's, I think it's the policy and policy certainty so that businesses can get along doing what they need to do. Steve,
do you want to add anything to that?
Not really.
Okay.
But
we're getting out of our
swim lane. We're definitely out of our swim lane. But
yeah, I think we're getting out of Dodge quickly. When I think Dodge is a really interesting place to be.
Right.
Siegfried.
Yeah, Siegfried.
That's certainly.
And not to belabor the point, but I do believe it's the uncertainty that presents itself that is holding up most of the investment, be it in Canada or, or Australia.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just government policy. You have a huge technology risk today with the replacement of technologies that are, you know, step changes of improvement. You have, you know, obviously some trade risk relative to what's going on in the world. And I guess I'd be interested in your commentary, because earlier I think what I heard was, why aren't hurdle rates coming down, given the low interest rate environment? And while I agree that does affect our weighted average cost of capital, some of these risks sort of counter that movement and continue to buoy up the returns for taking big bets on investments. And so we'd like to know how you guys drew up hurdle rate decline.
Okay, thanks, Siegfried. I mean, both of our comments were about risk-adjusted hurdle rates. And so perfectly entitled to say, oh my gosh, the range of outcomes in that project is this versus that. So I got to take that into account and take the worst case scenario and say, okay, now what's my hurdle rate after I've subtracted off that bad scenario? And what Phil's saying, and I'm saying, that when you've done that, the risk adjusted hurdle rate hasn't actually drifted down, even though global interest rates have obviously drifted down, and we're saying it's not a temporary thing. It's driven primarily by demographic forces that, you know, are 50 years in the making, and they'll be a long time, if ever, going away. And I think, so there's a risk there that we get perpetual underinvestment just because of those kind of standards that permeate our decision-making structures. And that other investors who have a longer horizon, perhaps, will snap up those opportunities instead. So that's the other side of this risk. Just a brief word. I didn't even answer his question right, so it's not really fair. So sustainable finance. I mean, look, we all know that. This whole business comes up. You know, the basic textbook analysis is that you do something, and I do something. We create. Let's say we're creating pollution, and neither one of us pays for it, right? It's just because it's just going in the air, and that's a public good. So it's internalizing that decision making. So let's say a guy across the street from you decides to open up a chip truck in his driveway, and people are all parking on your street and having great poutine and stuff like this, and it's like a really great deal for him, but really bad for the neighborhood, right? And so that's an externality. Well, in theory, it's possible for him to come around and say, I know I've cost you something, so I'm going to give you 2% of my profits, every householder, so you get something out of this too. That would be internalizing it, and that's a form of, if you like, sustainable finance. Okay, so it's getting those externalities of carbon release buried into the financial decisions. And as I argued before, I think the most important ingredient of that is for us to be able to see clearly, you know, transparently, where are things being generated, how much are they, how big are they. So if it's not clear, then we run the risk of these tumultuous shifts in our investment world. But if it's clear, it ought to be, you know, a transition, right? Maybe from now to 2050 or longer in its process. But it can be a very gradual one, and one that we can have visibility on, and it doesn't have to be an uncertain thing. But I think the first step is that transparency, to allow those externalities to be built into the financial decisions. And it would mean ultimately that, yes, if you're creating more carbon than your competitor, You would pay a modest risk premium in finance, and you would have a strong incentive to become more, as you've said, to invest in ways that reduce that over time. It would be clear to the markets, and that premium would go down through time. That's what sustainable finance is supposed to look like. So we use that as a code word as economists. It's got a huge literature in behind it. I hope, well, that's helpful, but anyway, that's the story.
So I'm conscious that we are now 4 seconds to 4 seconds over. We're in the negative.
Oh my!
So Phil, unless you're desperate to add anything,
no.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank on your behalf Phil and Steve for this illuminating discussion. So please.